conclusion is rejected, that it was necessary to create, that it was necessary to redeem, that conclusion is rejected. Yes. If one takes the view that the decrees are eternal, it would seem that the decrees are in some sense necessary. Then if they are necessary, the items included in the decrees would also appear to be necessary. That is, if you view various aspects of the decrees, all you're doing there is looking at various parts or aspects of the decrees. And then it was necessary for God to create and God to redeem. That is, those are parts, those are aspects, those are items in the decrees. That conclusion is rejected by Orthodox theology. If from eternity means before the first act of creation, then the decrees may be viewed as having been framed most freely by God's own determination and good pleasure. If the decrees are from eternity in the sense that they were formed or framed or formulated before the first act of creation, then they may be viewed as having been framed most freely by God's own determination and good pleasure. Mr. Upton.
Wouldn't many of those?
By and large, the implication of the timelessness of God and of the eternal quality of the decrees is not drawn. The implication is not drawn. Therefore, those who claim that the decrees are eternal, as you'll see in a number of confessions, do not realize what that implies with regard to the necessity of what is included in the decrees of God. They therefore make the various aspects of the decrees necessary. But they reject that. In other words, if they made it explicit, they would reject it. Yes, Mr. Christian. Well, if you talk about inception, if you talk about framing and formulation, it would appear that that would be the case. Yes. That has certain implications, I know. You can think about those in terms of God's foreknowledge. Yes, Mr. Perry. Okay, we'll come. Yeah, come in. That's good, you're thinking. Thirdly, the decrees are divine opera ad extra. They are distinguished from the purely immanent works of God, opera ad intra, in that they are works of the triune God which are immanent in God. They are works of the triune God which are immanent in God until they're realized in the works of creation, providence, and redemption. They are divine opera ad extra. They are considered to be immanent in God until they are realized in the works of creation, providence, and redemption. They're also viewed as works of God which bear directly on his creatures rather than purely immanent. Works of God within the Trinity, works of God within the Godhead. Yes, A. Immanent. Yes. Fourthly, yes. Well, works which are immanent but then realized in the works of creation, providence, and redemption. That is, they're framed, they're formulated in an immanent way within the Godhead. But then they have realization in that they bear directly on God's creatures. Yes, opera ad intra and opera ad extra. There are no purely then trans- Marshawn. Latin students here. Mr. Upton works to the outside, works to the inside. The terms immanent and transcendent are, of course, polar terms. And
there's no way you're going to win this one.
I can see that, yes. Immanent would mean within or inside. And immanent, when we're talking about immanent works, we're talking about works which are contained, as it were, within the Godhead. And you're really talking, when you're speaking of the opera ad intra, you're talking about works which are exclusively contained in the Godhead without any outward manifestation or without any external consequences. You may have a revelation of opera ad intra, but the works do not, use the other term, transcend, go outside, go beyond the Trinity itself. These works are not strictly opera ad intra, they're called opera ad extra. They have an immanent aspect in that they take place in formulation within the Trinity, but then as far as the implementation, they're opera ad extra. Yes, Mr. Father. Number four. The final cause of the decrees is God's glory. The final cause of the decrees is God's glory. Now, in Aristotle's four causes, the final cause is the end or goal toward which something moves. I'm going to talk further about Aristotle's causes in a page or so. But just for this point, the final cause in Aristotle's hierarchy of causes is the end or goal, sometimes called telos, the end or goal toward which something moves. To put it another way, using an illustration from botany, the fully developed character of being an oak tree, which an oak seed will attain. The fully developed character of being an oak tree, which an oak seed will attain. That's called the final cause, the fully developed character. See, it's in the seed. The potential is in the seed. But the fully developed character is called the final end in Aristotle's use. Or, to put it another way, the purpose for which an artist creates. The purpose for which an artist creates. Again, we'll discuss the four causes. The final cause is that which is determined at the beginning. And the term throws you because you think a final at the end. See, that's misleading. The final cause is determined at the beginning. Just as the oak seed, the final character of the tree is determined at the beginning, and the purpose for which the artist creates, that is determined at the beginning. That is, if there's any forethought given to it. That is, in this illustration, there is forethought given. And the final cause, therefore, comes at the beginning, which always confuses people. Because final, you think of something at the end. And there is something at the end, but it's determined at the beginning. Likewise, God's glory is the outcome determined by God at the formation of his decrees. That's very important. It is God's glory that is the outcome, the fully developed character of the decrees of God, which is determined by God at the formation of those decrees. God's glory is the outcome determined by God at the formation of his decrees. Number five, the decrees are immutable. Now, if God were essentially capricious, if he were capricious, or if he were unable to foresee some contingency, or if he were unable to carry out some aspect of his plan, any of those three, if he were capricious, if he were unable to foresee some contingency, or if he were unable to carry out some aspect of his plan, the first speaks to the question of the stability of God's character. The second speaks to the question of God's omniscience. The third speaks to the character of God's omnipotence. If there were some failure in any one of those three, then his decrees would of necessity be mutable, able to change, mutable. If, that is, if God is to achieve his great goal. Now, of course, you can forget about mutability and immutability if there's no necessity of God achieving any goal. If God just sets things in motion and hopes that they come out somehow all right at the end, then they may or may not. But since God is constant in his character and omniscient and omnipotent, there is no need of change in his decrees. There's no need of mid-course corrections. Any question, Mr. Christian? Whatever comes to pass, evil as well as good. Now this emphasis comports with such scriptures as Ephesians 1:11, at which we have looked, Acts 2:23, which is also in our list in the scriptural background, and Genesis 50, verse 20, where you will recall Joseph tells his brothers, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." Question, Mr. Beaver. No, that's not oversimplifying. It's just that the three categories are intended as general, part for the whole, and not necessarily inclusive of every possibility in the decree. They're just a representative categories, that's all. So for a kind of a shorthand in referring to the plans and the outworking of God's plans. Mr. Carr. Destroy human responsibility. You've got even a more serious problem there. The objection may be responded to by noting that, one, God clearly predicts that men will act in certain ways, yet those men are held responsible for their actions. We noted in some of the scriptures at which we looked that men were still considered to be wicked men and have wicked hands, even though God clearly predicted that they would act in certain ways regarding our Lord. Two, God foreknows as actual everything that comes to pass, yet certainty of futurition is not thereby destructive of free agency. I might say in that connection that Faustus and Laelius Socinus, the founders of what is called Socinianism, faced this problem rather squarely. They looked at what the Calvinists had done in framing the doctrine of the decrees, and they said, the Calvinists have God foreordaining everything that comes to pass, and because he foreordains everything that comes to pass, he foreknows everything that comes to pass, that is, with certainty. Because he has foreordained it, he foreknows it. They then looked at the Arminian position, and they noted that in the Arminian position, God foreordained everything that came to pass because he foreknew it. He foreknew everything that would come to pass, and he thereby, or therefore, foreordained it. The Socinians said, in either of those cases, you destroy free agency. in either of those cases. Because even if God, in the Arminian position, doesn't foreordain and thus foreknow, even if he simply foreknows everything, that fixes everything as certainly future. And so they not only rejected foreordination, they rejected foreknowledge. In that, they were quite consistent and quite logical. They rejected any kind of a determination of the future. And they felt that foreknowledge, even foreknowledge, was in some sense determinative. Therefore, God could not foreknow the future in the Socinian view. We would, of course, counter that with this statement that clearly Scripture reveals that God foreknows what comes to pass. And in fact, he makes a number of predictions of the future based upon his foreknowledge of the future, and that based upon his foreordination. And yet, this question of free agency still hangs. Number three, God's decrees cannot properly be said to cause whatever comes to pass. Now, here's the nub of the issue, right here. Some events are caused, other events are simply guaranteed certainty of futurition. Now, this emphasis distinguishes the causative and the permissive aspects of God's determinative will. The causative and the permissive aspects of God's determinative will. In the causative aspect, this aspect, God determines to cause morally good states or actions in personal beings. God determines to cause morally good states or actions in personal beings. In the permissive aspect, he determines to render certainly future. He determines to render certainly future morally evil states or actions in personal beings. In the permissive aspect, he determines to render certainly future morally evil states or actions in personal beings. Now, the difficulty in this distinction is that Aristotle's four classes of causality, formal cause, material cause, efficient cause, final cause, that these four classes are insufficient to explain the difference between causative and permissive as used in this context. I mean, that is a nice classification of causality. It's very useful, but it's insufficient. It's not that there's a problem with it, it's simply insufficient to explain this difference between causative and permissive. Calvin attempted to distinguish between what he referred to as proximate and remote cause, or ultimate. Proximate and remote, or ultimate cause of sinful actions and states. Calvin struggled with this. He tried to distinguish between the proximate cause of sinful actions and states and the remote cause of sinful actions and states. Calvin asserted that the sinner is the proximate cause. The sinner is the proximate cause. Whereas God is the remote cause. That is, of sinful actions and states. The problem with this distinction in Calvin, which is found in his treatise on predestination, the problem is that unless
remote cause excludes responsibility,
then the distinction does not help. Unless remote cause excludes responsibility, the distinction does not help. J. Oliver Buswell, Jr. proposed another classification which he felt should be added to Aristotle's four causes, and which he called chargeable, creditable cause. J. Oliver Buswell, Jr. That's a little confusing. That's the elderly gentleman who died recently. Mr. Basil. Let's finish this, and it may only be a whole bugger. J. Oliver Buswell, Jr. asserted that God is not the chargeable cause, breaking up the term, the chargeable cause of moral evil. But he is the creditable cause of moral good. See, the problem is that Aristotle's categories do not fix responsibility in a moral sense. And therefore, what Buswell is proposing is merely an idea, a concept, in which the assertion is made that God is not the chargeable cause of moral evil, but is the creditable cause of moral good, which is really another way of saying that God is in no sense the author of sin. But it makes another assertion. It says he is the author of all good. Now, of course, that has to be put together in some way with free agency, with the part that man plays in his actions, that is, in human actions. Question, Mr. Schmitz. Of what? Yes, later. Mr. Michael, if men can do some things, even under the providence of God, which spring from themselves, God determines, and remember we're talking about before the foundation of the world, God determines to permit these men to do what they desire and what they determine to do. So what you do is you afford a relative sense of independent action on the part of men. I've suggested another category in the will of God. That's a big area that you need more categories than are usually afforded to you to explain it. And this category, which simply addresses itself to what God desires, what God on the whole is pleased with, what God on the whole would prefer, but which for good reasons sufficient to himself, he does not bring to pass.
considerative.
Where would you add?
Sin in the universe. But for reasons sufficient to himself, he did not prevent its entrance. And you could say that God, on the whole, desires or prefers the salvation of all men. But for good reasons, he does not cause it to happen. I'm going to do things a little differently today. The last time we were together, we were at the bottom of page 29. I'm going to address myself simply to a point or two as we go through a number of pages today. So please try to stay with me and follow along. You have a new set of sheets, and we'll go through those as well. At the bottom of page 29, I make an emphasis on free agency, which is to be distinguished from free will. Free agency, a free agent is one who is free to act in accordance with his nature, with what he is. A free moral agent is one who is free to decide not contrary to, but in accordance with his own moral nature. So he is free to do what he is. That is, connecting actions with will and connecting will as an expression of nature. I'm going to skip over to number two. That can be read with some profit. And number three, the decrees make God the author of sin. That's mostly a block of material, and you can read that on your own. Page 33, we take up the doctrine of creation. There are three statements here, very, very comprehensive statements, and then some scriptural background to the doctrine. The scriptural background mostly has to do with the kinds of things that the scripture says God created. And the thrust of all of those scriptures is that, of course, God created all things. Now, in the development of the doctrine on page 34, you notice that the first point, creation is a free act of God, and there are certain implications there. It's not a necessary act. God did not need to create. Number two, and number three, it's an act arising out of God's sovereign good pleasure on page 35, with a couple of scriptures. Just a couple of points under B on page 35. Creation is a temporal act of God. Three points in particular. I'll make them very brief. Number one, under B on page 35, by a temporal act is meant, of course, that it is not an eternal act. That is, it is not an eternal bringing into being of that which is not the Creator. So by temporal act, first is meant that it is not an eternal act. God said, "Let there come into existence," and it was so. By temporal act is meant that it is not an eternal act, not an eternal bringing into being of that which is not the Creator. And number two, by temporal act is meant that it is an act of God which occurs at a point in the sequence of God's own ongoing self-experience. It occurs at a point in God's self-experience. That is, by temporal act is meant in this second point that there is a point before he begins to exert power to bring the universe into being, and there is a point after he begins to create. So it is an act of God which occurs at a point in his self-experience. There's a point before he begins to create, there is a point after he begins to create. That's the second meaning of temporal acts. And thirdly, the third point, by temporal act is also meant that it is an act of God which brings into existence the time dimension of the physical universe. By temporal act, thirdly, is meant that it brings time, the time dimension of the physical universe, into existence. And by the time dimension of the physical universe, we mean primarily the feature of duration measured by physical movement and change. So temporal act is used, that is, by temporal act, we clarify the point three ways. First, it is meant that it is not an eternal act. Second, that it occurs at a point in God's own self-experience. There is a before it and there is an after it. And thirdly, that it brings time measured by physical movement and change into being. That is time in the physics sense. The time dimension. We talk about time space. The time dimension of the physical universe. So those three points. I'm not going to extenuate those because I have a lot to cover today. We're not going to enlarge upon the point C, the triune God is the author of creation. Those are scriptures which can be looked at. I do want to extenuate a bit on page 36, theories which oppose the doctrine, dualism, emanationism, creation from eternity, and naturalistic evolutionism. First, dualism. This view holds to the eternity of God and to the eternity of matter, and thus dismisses the idea of a creation without the use of previously existing matter. That is, it dismisses the idea of creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. What is the problem with holding to the eternity of matter? Some have raised that question. What's the problem? Why not? Why can't we say that God and matter are eternal, both? The problem is that it makes matter equally ultimate with God. It makes matter equally ultimate with God, in which case matter is self-sustaining. If matter is equally ultimate with God, and I won't take time to go into the question of what ultimate means, it is admittedly a philosophic concept, but in this case, matter is self-sustaining. Now, that appears to be contradicted by such scriptures as Colossians 1:17, where we read, "And he, Christ, is before all things, and by him all things hold together or endure." That does not seem to give the impression that matter is self-sustaining. Now, of course, dualism could avoid the charge, or could attempt to avoid the charge, that it makes matter equally ultimate with God by arguing that matter can be viewed as being eternally dependent upon God. See, someone may take that as an alternate. They may say, yes, matter is eternal, but it is not equally ultimate with God. It is eternally dependent upon God. But if one takes that tack, then we must ask, in what sense is matter dependent upon God? I think that's the crucial question. If someone says, I believe that matter is eternal, but that it is not equally ultimate with God, it is eternally dependent upon God, then the next question which we must raise is, in what sense is matter dependent upon God? Is it dependent upon God for its existence? Well, obviously not if matter is eternal. Obviously not if matter is eternal. Then the further question which we must raise is, what does dependent mean in that case? If matter is not dependent for God upon its existence, that is, if one says matter is eternal, then in what sense is that person using the word dependent? What does dependent mean? Dualism, therefore, raises more problems than it possibly can solve. Emanationism is the view that holds that the universe is of the same substance as God and is the product of the overflow of the fullness of his being. I won't take time to diagram Plotinus's view. Plotinus, of course, is the classic example of emanationism. This view, emanationism, destroys the very concept of creation. And in doing so, destroys the creator-creature distinction. Emanationism destroys the very concept of creation, that is, creation as a bringing into being of that which is not the creator. A bringing into existence of that which is not the creator. Emanationism destroys that idea because in emanationism, the universe is an overflow of God's substance, the fullness of his being. So it is not a bringing into being of that which is not God. And thus it destroys the creator-creature distinction. And that distinction is made again and again throughout Scripture. The third view, creation from eternity, holds that since there is no time with God, that is, it asserts the timelessness of God, and since God created the universe with time or into time, therefore his initial act of creation must have occurred in eternity and must therefore be eternal. Thus, creation is an eternal act. The question which must be raised here is, what is an eternal act? What is an eternal act? There are two possible ways that can be taken, with perhaps some other possibilities. Does an eternal act, does this mean that God's initial act of creation has no effect for eons before the coming into being of the matter-energy complex, and then no effect afterward? That is, for eons it has no effect, then it has an effect, and then it has no effect for eons afterward? Or does it mean that God's initial act of creation is an eternal act of bringing into being the matter-energy complex, thus ruling out any real beginning or ending of the universe? It is an eternal act of bringing into being the matter-energy complex, thereby ruling out any real beginning or ending of the universe. If one takes that second tack, then we must raise the question, then how shall we understand the scriptural revelation? It seems to make the scriptural revelation meaningless. Now, I'm not going to expand upon the fourth view, naturalistic evolutionism. That is a whole game in itself, and much too lengthy to expand upon here. Mr. Dixon, quick question. Point one, under creation from eternity, does it mean that God's initial act of creation, the act of initially bringing matter energy into existence, does it mean that that act has no effect? God acts, but it doesn't take effect for eons. Then it takes effect and that brings matter energy into existence, and then after that it has no effect for eons. An eternal act. An eternal act, but which has no effect for eons, has effect, and then has no effect for eons after. The second tack is that God's initial act of creation, the initial act, the act of bringing matter energy into existence, is an eternal act of bringing the matter, of bringing into being the matter energy complex. God is eternally bringing the matter-energy complex into being. He's eternally doing that. It has no beginning. It has no ending. Yes, continuous creation. Thank you. The question I raised on that is, how shall we understand then the scriptural revelation, which speaks of a beginning, which speaks of an ending, which says something that this universe as we presently know it is going to come to an end, that there's going to be a great change, and it speaks of the very elements of the universe. and Mr. Morrison. Okay, I'm going to skip over page 37, except it's not really necessary for me to put in the Greek and the Hebrew, but I will. On the bottom of page 37, under 3A, good angel, Michael is called the archangel in the Bible. We're not sure. Gabriel may also be an archangel. Perhaps the seven angels of Revelation 8:2 are archangels. Cherubim, cherubim, or cherubim. You make your face all hard, I guess. No soft face. And seraphim, say 6:2-6. We're not going to take the time to look up these scriptures. That would be very valuable and interesting study. Page 39. Fascinating to note under number 4, the variety of services for God and for His children that the good angels perform. That's a whole fascinating area in itself. Unfortunately, it's been subjected to a considerable amount of speculation. Many implications drawn from very little exegetical base. Page 40, the creation of the material world. I suggest here three meanings of the term creation: ex nihilo creation, the bringing into being of that which did not either in its substance or its form previously exist. Basically, we're talking about the matter-energy complex. By speaking of the matter-energy complex, you understand that matter is a form of energy. It's in one particular form. So we can speak of the matter-energy complex. Immediate creation is the bringing into being of that which did not in its form previously exist, employing previously existing substance but not secondary causes. That's rather carefully defined. And then mediate creation, the bringing into being of that which did not in its form previously exist, employing both previously existing substance and secondary causes. Now, I have a proposed structuring of the creative events of Genesis 1 and 2, and I'd like to distribute this handout to go along with this proposal. Dr. Newman has a proposal on this. I don't know what you've done with Dr. Vinoy in this area. If I guess you have in Old Testament history. Mr. Harbert. And Dr. Newman has a proposal also in this connection. Now, if you lay the two side by side, this diagram with page number 40, you notice in the proposed structuring, I have a pre-day one, a pre-creation day one. Now, that means on page 40, when it's under C2A, pre-creation day one, it should be read this way. We're talking about a period prior to creation day one. It's hard to express, but that's what that term pre-creation day one means. In other words, creation day one goes together. Creation day one. This is pre-creation day one. Okay? Because if you look at that code, you're not sure what that means. It's talking about a period prior to creation day one. And in that, I proposed these three: ex nihilo creation of primal matter energy, mediate creation of the structured universe, mediate creation of the Milky Way galaxy, which is the galaxy in which we find ourselves today. And then creation day one, and I've listed under each one of these various aspects of God's creative activity. Now, here's the point on the diagram. You see, I've got creative aspects. Number one, number two, number three, number four, five, six, seven. Creative aspects, or phases of God's creative activity. Phases is not exactly the word I want. Aspects is better. In aspect number one, you have these creative activities of God, which are listed on page 40 under 2A. Now, my proposal is that there are various periods of creative activity on the part of God, and that in the diagram they overlap to a considerable extent. So we're not really talking about separate time periods, but separate aspects of God's creative activity, some of which overlap in time. And in each one of the creative aspects, there are three stages. There is first the stage in which you have the beginning, the initiation of the creative aspect, in which God says, let there be. Secondly, you have a point in God's creative activity in that aspect, at which God looks upon what he has brought into being and views it as good, that is good for his purposes, for his ends, in the horizon of his goals. And that I identify with the literal 24-hour days denominated day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, day seven. Now you notice, when you combine these, noticing that there are time periods that overlap, you notice that day one precedes day two chronologically. So the days, the literal 24-hour days, are in order. They are in succession. They are not in immediate succession. That is, day two is not a 24-hour period, which is the next 24-hour period after day one. So, for instance, on the diagram, between day two and day three, there may be a vast amount of time. And between day four and day five, a vast amount of time. So the proposal is of literal days separated in many cases by vast periods of time, but that each of the creative aspects begins with a fiat, a let there be, comes to a point of essential completion in which God looks upon his creative activity and pronounces it good, and that's a literal day, and then a completion stage. So there's a beginning stage or phase, a phase or stage of essential completion in which God pronounces his creative activity good, not technically good, but good for the ends for which he is created. There's no suggestion here that God, as we would create a chair, make a chair, and then look upon it and say, that's a good chair. There's no suggestion here of a technical sense of good, but a teleological sense of good. Good for the ends for which God purposes his creative activity. And certainly no sense of a moral good. No sense of a moral good. God looks upon his work and says it's morally good. No sense of that at all. So you should put together these creative events on page 40 with the diagram in order to get the concept of this proposal. At the bottom of the diagram, I have a correlation with geology and paleontology. The correlation is rather good, by the way. but it's very complicated to explain. On page 41, you notice the proposed chronological framework for the creative events of Genesis 1 to 2. I just gave you that in the diagram. Okay? So in other words, I'm not going to give you something separate. That goes in where the space is provided on page 41. So you could just insert the diagram after page 41 and it would be the same thing. I won't draw the diagram. Mr. Marchand. A day which is measured by the relationship of the earth to the sun. That represents one phase of God's creative activity, which necessarily occupies a certain amount of time. But the time, what you need to do is then put them all together, melt all of the aspects together in order to get one timeline. In other words, what you're doing is you're looking at the same amount of time when you put it together, but you're taking it apart in order to look at various phases of God's creative activity. You're looking at the same time, but it overlaps. There was another question over here. Don't try to bang your head on it. It won't help anyway. On page 42, the meaning and implications of the created kinds of Genesis. Two more handouts. Day three is a 24-hour period, one of the 24-hour days that comes in that great period of time. On day three, God looks upon his activity and finds it to be essentially complete, sufficiently complete for him to pronounce that it is good. So it is not does all the creating in a single day. He creates all through the period during between the slash marks. But on that particular day, enough has been completed of his creative activity that he can pronounce it good. Okay? Complete for God. Implications of the creative kinds of Genesis. On the first of these two handouts, you have a translation of the various usages of the Hebrew word mean with the preposition la. La mean. Within the King James Version is translated after its kind. Which I have translated according to its kind or kinds. Or various kinds of. Notion that love with mean means that something came after something else and was like it. Because that's the way we ordinarily think of after its kind. That something came after something else, that is its parent, and was like it. Whereas love with mean, I would propose, does not have that idea at all. First of all, it doesn't have the idea of something coming after its parent. Secondly, it doesn't have the idea of being like its parent. Neither idea. But that it simply means, in the creative uses, that is, the uses that pertain to creation, that God created this kind of plant or animal, whatever it's talking about, Genesis 1, maybe. Or that God created various kinds of that plant or animal. The word kind, which is used to translate mean, when we analyze its usages,
according to the classification of plants and animals, that is a scientific classification, which is fairly well accepted, we discover that mean does not mean species. Sometimes Bible translators and scholars have taken the Hebrew word mean to be equivalent to species. It has no equivalent as such in the classification hierarchy. Mean is not equivalent to species or genus or family or order or class or phylum or kingdom. It's not equivalent to any one of those levels in the classification of living things. Mean appears to be a general word. It means types of or kinds of or varieties of, and varieties not in a technical sense, that is, varieties of a subspecies, but in the general sense, when you talk about varieties of pickles, you're talking about kinds of cars, or kinds of houses, or kinds of hairstyles. You're using the word kinds or types. You're using it in a very general sense. That's the way the word mean is used. It has no equivalent as such in the scientific hierarchy of classification. And in this analysis of the taxonomic level, taxonomy simply means classification, of the biblical kinds, you discover under the heading taxonomic level that the kinds spoken of in these usages of mean in the Old Testament may be found at various levels of the classification. You can't identify the word with any one level, whether species or genus or family or order or class or phylum or kingdom. Now, what are the implications of that? Well, there are several. First of all,